Morning.
Good morning.
So this morning, I want to talk about the conditioned and the unconditioned. I want to talk about relationship and no relationship. And I want to start by talking about Buddha's experience during his awakening. That is what we know of it. And it's surrounded by mythology. Nevertheless, this is what the Pali scriptures say actually happened. So whether it actually happened or not, it's an archetype for us as Buddhist practitioners. So, for those of you who know this story, after his 6 years of trying all these different meditation approaches and going through this fasting and doing all of this purification, he sat down under the Bodhi tree and said he was just going to sit like we do and take food and nourish his body and just going to sit. And so during the last 12 hours of this sitting, in the middle of the night, he had a vision. The vision was of the interdependence of all life. He saw this chain of plants, animals, rocks, human beings even, interconnected, influencing each other, conditioning each other, relating to each other. And supposedly, this went on for quite a while, this vision. We say no visions in Zazen. Well, what about Buddha? This was a very profound vision for him. This changed the whole course of his life and was central to his teaching. His vision of interconnectedness. His vision of the fact that everything we do is the cause of everything else. And also the effect of everything else. Anything we feel, anything we think, anything we see. Kind of wonderful and kind of scary, isn't it? Depending on how you look at it. So, my examples for this morning are guy at 3M loses his job. He loses his job because they're downsizing. Well, they're downsizing because they're sending the work to China, right? They're sending the work to China because they open a new factory in China and they can do it more economically. And why can they do it more economically? Well, in this case, they can do it more economically because of the interest they're earning from the United States government. The United States government is lending them money. This is actually what's happening. Lending them money at a pretty good interest rate. So they can afford to open these factories to do this work. So this guy, and then this guy also will receive unemployment comp from the U.S. government, which it borrowed the money to give to him. So he loses. So that's just the way life goes, the way everything goes. another example is the example of me and my different illnesses, but I'm just going to talk about one illness right now. So, however many years ago, I don't remember. Was it 2 years ago? Probably 3 years ago at Hokkyoji, our Zen, well, not ours, Dokai's, the whole world's Zen Mountain Center. Dokai gave us very specific instructions about how to deal with ticks, about how to keep from ticks off us, deer ticks. And I thought I was doing a pretty good job, but I had a couple of lapses. A couple of times I thought, oh, shit, you know. Excuse me, but that's what I thought. Enough of this. We're in nature. I have to, every time I go outside, tuck my pants in my socks. Ridiculous. Well, what happened? I got Lyme's disease. I got a tick. I got Lyme's disease. as a result of that Lyme disease, I had to be hospitalized. I passed out. I had to be hospitalized. My wife was gone. Paris was there all by myself in the hospital. Luckily, my son came to visit me every day. My son was working full time and still came to visit me every day. And I've been unwell ever since, basically. I've been unwell ever since. My immune system is not good. Not good. So there we have one little behavior on my part. But, of course, everything is the cause and the effect of everything else. So it's I don't need to blame myself. There's some cause for me doing that, and a lot of effects, and a lot of things happened as a result of that. And also as a result of that, I never know what one of my favorite things is to lead retreats, to lead sesshins. That's one of my favorite things in life, and I never know whether I'm going to be able to do it because I don't know what my energy is going to be like. And also as a result of that, I've developed relationships with a kinesiologist that I never had before, with a homeopathist that I never had before. I learned all about homeopathy. I didn't learn anything more about Western medicine because my doctor just shrugs his shoulders, you know, when I go see him. Went to Chinese medicine, an acupuncturist, herbal medicine. So all that happened, all that working together. And you guys can all think of your own examples, right? So everything is relationship. Everything is relationship. It's what Buddha talked about. And he talked about how, since everything is relationship, we need to cultivate wholesome dharmas. We need to cultivate healthy emotions to support each other, to support all beings in this relationship. So much of Buddhist teaching focuses on that, focusing on healthy emotional development, so we can have a healthy emotion which then reverberates throughout our neighborhood and our world. And he lists these healthy emotions. Here's a list. This is a short list of the healthy emotions, right? Delight, enthusiasm, contentment, tranquility, peace, ardency, A-R-D-E-N-C-Y, from ardent, faith, empathy for others, patience, and various forms of love. So all of these are to promote spiritual maturity and the capacity to live happily with an engaged attitude in the world. Ticks or no ticks. Lyme's disease or no Lyme's disease. Everybody has their own version of this, what I'm talking about. You all have your own versions. So in my last talk, I talked about a poem by Rumi, which is a favorite poem of mine, and I talked about the whole long thing, but I'm going to review a couple of lines this morning. Just throw away all thoughts of imaginary things and stand firm in what you are. Just throw away all thought of imaginary things and stand firm in what you are. So in our meditation practice, whether we're regular meditators or irregular meditators, whether we're deep meditators or shallow meditators, we're visited by a lot of beings. We're visited by a lot of ghosts, a lot of voices, a lot of people, versions of ourselves or our ideas about others. We're visited by those. And we have to throw them away in our meditation. We have to throw them away. And we need positive emotion to help us do that. We need positive emotion. If we can generate some enthusiasm in our meditation for throwing them away. We can begin you to do ghost busting, voice busting. You need a lot of enthusiasm to do ghost busting, to do voice busting, because they keep coming back. They keep coming back. Doesn't matter how long you sit, how many great, profound experiences you have. Coming back, coming back. Right? Oh boy. The life situation, isn't it? So, enthusiasm. Ardency. We have to be ardent about this. If we don't really make a big effort, those ghosts will just become the norm. I mean, they've been the norm already, but they'll just continue to be the norm. And gee, they create so much trouble, and they're so burdensome, and they're so ultimately unnecessary. Ultimately unnecessary. But we need to work with positive emotion to help us. Faith. We need to have faith in this process. This process that sometimes seems to work, sometimes doesn't work. Sometimes our mind's clear, sometimes it'll never be clear. Faith that we can do it. That not just Tim. Tim's not some special guy. I'm not a special guy. Just faith. And patience. It takes a lot of patience. A lot of patience. Last time Ben was talking about one of the positive emotions, metta, loving kindness. And he gave us some, we practiced here loving kindness meditation, which is a tried and proven ghost busting technique. We went through it. We did it. We did it. And it's, we can stand firm in who we are and what we are. So a few days ago, I was talking to my wife, and she started playing the flute about 7 or 8 years ago. She retired from her private practice as a psychologist and let her license go and said she was going to play the flute instead. Well, what a deal, huh? But the other day she said to me, well, you know, I want to try to commit myself to playing the flute more. She said, I try to play for at least 20 minutes a day, but I get impatient. And I really know that I need to play for 45 minutes or an hour a day. And I said, what do you mean you need to? And she said, well, when I play that long, I start to feel more enthusiastic, positive emotion, because I see that I'm actually beginning to incorporate this in me, this flute playing in me. If I just play 15 minutes every other day, I'm always struggling. I'm always there back at the beginning. And she said, but it takes patience. And I said, oh, it's just like meditation, Linda. And she didn't answer me. But it is. It's just like meditation. Just like it. And the positive emotion that underlies all this stuff is really love. Now, you don't find love talked about much in the sutras, but you do find talked about continually a warm, tender, sympathetic attitude of the heart. Well, that's not love. What is? A warm, sympathetic, empathic, and tender attitude of the heart. That's the most important of the positive emotions. So we have the four immeasurables in Buddhism, the four Brahma Viharas, and they're all based on love, different types of love. The metta, the loving kindness love, is the first one. The compassion, karuna, is the second. Sympathetic joy is the third. And an emotion that we generally don't equate with love is the fourth. And that's equanimity. It's really hard to have deep love without equanimity. So, of course, this kind of love is not adolescent romantic love. It's not the love that involves craving or grasping. It's not the love that needs anything beyond itself. Isn't that wonderful? It doesn't need anything beyond itself. Wow. Aren't we lucky? Aren't we lucky that that positive notion, emotion is available to us at the root of all the positive emotions? We're lucky. So if we look carefully at our relationships, we can begin to appreciate how our lives are thoroughly intertwined with other people's. And then we can begin to, and other beings. Well, in my last talk I talked about, was that my talk before, I talked about rocks. Our interconnection with rocks. And I have a wonderful book that I've been reading every day on rocks that one of my friends lent to me. After my talk. Wonderful. Rocks. Doesn't say too much. Just has a few words, but lots of great pictures of rocks. Rocks speak just as they are. They speak. So we can appreciate how thoroughly dependent we are on each other. How thoroughly dependent we are. When I went to the hospital, I was there all by myself. My wife was in Paris. Nobody knew I was even in the hospital, except my son. He came every day, totally dependent on him. And I felt really gratitude, and it deepened my relationship with him, because that situation called up his best. His most compassionate, his most loving for his dad. And then I was available too. I wasn't rushing off to the Zen Center. I was just there in bed. So we had a cool time for 3 days. Cool time. So I appreciate that. I feel grateful for that. And yesterday I went for a walk. And my relationship with my body has changed a lot the last couple of years, because I, for most of my life, I exercised every day. I loved to be outside. I swam, I biked, I did something outside every day, even in the winter. The minute we came to Minnesota, you know, we didn't come from here, but that's another story. Mm-hmm. I got cross-country skis, you know. I was out every day of that first winter. But now I've been forced to be more in touch with my body. Because all those years, I just took it for granted. I just took it for granted. But because of the Lyme's disease and because of other predicaments, like I can't even sit half lotus right now, I've had to pay attention to my body. I had to appreciate that it's here supporting me. In a way I never needed to before. Of course, I don't have to appreciate it, but I do. I do. Yesterday, I went for a 15-minute walk. I didn't quite make it to the lake, but I saw the lake. I saw it. I was on 31st and something like Irving, and I saw the lake. Ooh. And I felt joy. Whereas in the old days, you know, I'd do 25-30 miles of bike ride, barely see the lake, go around the lakes, all the lake, go to the river, down to Fort Snelling. Took it for granted, right? So we always have a chance to cultivate these healthy emotions and to feel the gratitude of our interdependence on each other. We always have that opportunity. And of course, it doesn't mean I don't have to remind myself. I do. It doesn't mean I don't have to cultivate the healthy emotions myself. I do. I start to piss and moan, too. I start to feel sorry for myself, too. Well, I got all this material from Buddha has given me to work with, to play with, not just to work with. Don't work too hard with it. But there is another side to this interconnectedness, which I've just pointed out, and that is that this tight relationship that we have with each other and with everything is fraught with danger. My example, as you can see, it's fraught with danger because just failing to tuck my socks into my pants one time created this whole situation that's gone on now for 3 years. Danger all around, you guys. You better watch out. We support. I mean, I'm not. I don't mean to be political here. This is not my. Our government generously is supporting someone who's unemployed by borrowing money from the Chinese, so the Chinese can take our jobs, our American jobs. Danger, danger. Paranoia. Join the Tea Party. Join the Zen Party. Paranoia. We always want to join a party. I don't mean a party, fun party. I mean, when we get so that's true. That's the other side. Definitely, you can't ignore that. That's why working with the positive emotions is so important. And you know, if you go back through the early scriptures, you find lots and lots of stuff on this. Not so much in Mahayana, but in the early scriptures. And the Mahayana people work with this material. And then, of course, also, since everything is interrelated, everything is unstable and unpredictable. Everything is unstable and unpredictable. The relationship that we have right now might totally alter. You could begin to be getting early Alzheimer's. Or I could begin. Me as the teacher. Who would tell me? Who would tell me if I started to get early Alzheimer's? I'm early enough to get this. Good. Good. I need some people like that. We all need some people like that. My wife's best friend, one of her best friends, has just come down with early Alzheimer's. My wife has been having coffee with this woman for 30 years, every month. And now this woman, whom I'll call Jane, doesn't always show up for the coffee. And I said to Linda, well, gee, I thought Jane was really dependent. She said, yeah, but she just found out she has early Alzheimer's. And I thought, oh my, oh my. So we never know. We never know. Unstable and unpredictable are these relationships in this web of interdependence. And our happiness seems to wax and wane, depending on whether the relationship is working or not. Nevertheless, we have all this support. And Ben led us through this guided metta meditation last time. There are also, you can find in the literature, guided meditations for all these different positive emotions. And they're cool. And we should do them more, too, I think. We need more ghost busting. Rather than just going, coming back to the cushion and trying to be strong. So that's relationship, right? Relationship. Now, the other side, I'm not going to talk so much about relationship and the conditioned, and then no relationship, the unconditioned. I'm not going to talk so much about that because there's not much to say about it. Anything I say needs to be negated, right? No relationship. So Buddha had his vision. Siddhartha had his vision. And his vision supposedly went on for a long time, seeing these plants and animals and beings. And he saw gods, too, being interdependent, you know, because they all believed in gods. Gods and goddesses influenced the humans, supporting the plants turning into gods. You know, it's very psychedelic if you read different renditions of his vision, right? And then at the end of his vision, everything stopped. Everything completely stopped. And he went into a deep calmness. A deep, deep calmness. Which there was no relationship. No relationship. And supposedly he said, only I, alone and sacred. Only I, alone and sacred. No relationship. No relationship. The unconditioned. And that became the other part of his teaching about the unconditioned. So if you look at his teaching, and you look at any good Zen teacher's teaching, I guess, whatever a good Zen teacher is, it includes both sides. Includes both sides. No relationship. In meditation, in our meditation, it seems like we have lots of relationships. Things and people coming up, things we should have done, mistakes we made, things we're promising to do, over and over and over again. Compulsive and stressful, right in the middle of our meditation. How dare? Here we are sitting so calmly, we've made our commitment. How dare they? How, you know what I mean? How dare me, or whatever. But there it is. There it is. All over. Processing all those relationships. We're reviewing them, we're rehearsing them, we're regretting them, we're anticipating. All that relationship. And even with our healthy emotions. Yes, we're bringing more metta practice in, more healthy practice in. And then we're, should I do it more? Did I do it enough? The shit keeps coming up. Oh, I'll be kind to the shit too. Oh, I say things to it, but it's still. Comes in another door. On and on and on. And then we get discouraged with our meditation practice. And like my wife with her flute, we want to go down to 10 minutes every 2 or 3 days. But then we lose our ardor. We lose our ardor. That positive emotion of our ardor. And we just say, oh, screw it. You know, life is short, right? Life is short. But as our meditation deepens, we can begin to sense that the mind itself, at its base, it doesn't need to be constantly relating to anything. It doesn't need to constantly relate to any image, any thought, any person, any plan. Doesn't need to. Doesn't need to. It's possible to experience a peace that's non-relational. At any time, it's possible to experience a peace that is non-relational. Instead of trying to control, change, cling to these so-called healthy emotions. And we do this through the practice of what? Non-doing. 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 Letting go of our efforts to accomplish, to be someone, to get better, to get quieter, to be more compassionate. To avoid those yucky thoughts. Practicing non-doing. Wu Wei in Taoism, non-doing. Wu Wei. And if we practice non-doing, what happens? At some point, we experience some great stillness. Maybe it only lasts this long, or maybe it lasts a long time, but we experience it. Wow! Finally happened, Tim. Cool. Good for you. all I say usually.
Cool, good for you. What more is there to say?
If you say anything more about it, you make a religion out of it. We have too much religion already. Zen is already too full of religion. Too full of religion. And then we want to have that peace again. We want it back. We want it back. And then we have to practice letting go. Letting go. Letting go of that want. Letting go of that desire. Oh, I'm going to sit in Zazen more now. I'm really going to do the next practice period. And in the next practice period, I'm going to commit myself to more sitting. And I'm going to tell Tim at the beginning, so that'll help me. We want more. This is the human situation, right? But we need to let go of that. And then sometimes we're trying to let go and we shouldn't even try. What are you letting go of? It's no relationship. There's nothing to let go of. Then just let it be. Who's letting what be? Be lets be, right? Let be. Let be. And then our preoccupations, even with positive emotions, drop away. They drop away. And when this happens, something, a wellspring comes up. I don't know what it is exactly. You can call it love, you can call it empathy, you can call it insight, but a wellspring comes up. Comes up. And all the intentional activity and relational activity stops. Stops. So in Zen practice, one of our goals is to develop confidence in this possibility for you, for each of you, not for someone else, for each of you. It doesn't matter what your past has been like. It doesn't matter how your mind has been crazy. It doesn't matter. And even better, as you develop that confidence and go into it and begin to sense the continued background presence of no relationship, the unconditioned. Only you alone and sacred, right? Right? So we can live in the relational world with some ease, with some good humor, with some joy, maybe even a little bit of wisdom. You don't need very much wisdom. Wisdom is overrated. People who try to be wise are usually not that wise. But a little bit of wisdom. A little bit. So, this is our practice, the relational and the non-relational. That's our practice. And we need both dimensions. Both dimensions are really important. If we just do the non-relational, what happens? What happens? Well, we may have some great experience of peace and the non-relational, but when we're hanging out with our wife, we have to pay attention to the fact that she has certain needs, that she's coming from a certain place, and that relationship is what is with our cat, with our dog. That was important to pay attention to, or we could become like those Zen teachers who have been in disgrace on the Sweeping Zen the last few months. If you want to read about it. On the other hand, if you just do relationship, you'll be in the briar patch for your whole life. You'll be smelling beautiful flowers and the positive emotions, but you'll get snarled up, even in the positive ones, because even those roses have thorns when you're trying to control them, when you're trying to produce the best rose, when you're trying to complement the colors. So we need both. Simple. That's our practice. But it's not a practice. Well, it is a practice. From the non-relational, there's no practice. From a relational, boy, is it a practice. moment after moment. And so Suzuki Roshi said, each of you is perfect as you are, and you could all use a little improvement. He said that to us in a retreat. First he said the first one, and I thought, oh, wow. Yeah. Then he said the second one, and I thought, oh, no. The unconditioned and the conditioned. So I think that's what I want to say for this morning. Questions, comments from anybody about anything? Yeah.
One of the really beautiful things to me about Sam and Mariana being the guardian, as you used to say, relational, condition, unconditioned. Samsara and Nirvana, they don't really seem to be different. Can you say something about that?
Can I say something about Nagarjuna's?
Well, I mean,
that we don't have the duality of knowing conditioned and non-conditioned. Yeah. Well, Nagarjuna, when he says that, he's talking about the most of Nagarjuna's focus is on non-relational. Most of his focus is on the unconditioned. And but he does talk about conventional reality, and conventional reality is the relational, is the conditioned. So so do you guys know who Nagarjuna is? So Nagarjuna is the first major deconstructionist in Buddhism. That is, he took all the Buddhist teaching, which included discussion of happy emotions, of unhappy emotions, of wholesome and of unwholesome, of things you needed to do, to all this, the first part of my talk, right? And he deconstructed it. He said, that's all fabrication. It's within conventional reality, it's necessary, but it's all fabrication. You should know the unconditioned. You should know the non-relational. Of course, there's no you to know it. And he takes apart that you too, right? So his focus is totally on the non-relational. Although he does say conventional reality is important. Then after him, we have Yogacara coming up. And Yogacara is saying, wait, I'm talking to Ben because Ben's going to teach a great course in Yogacara. When's it coming up, Ben?
June 16th.
Yogacara comes up after, and it says, well, wait a second. It's true that there is the unconditional, and that it's possible to deconstruct everything so you experience a great peace. But what about all that nifty stuff from early Buddhism, all that relational stuff? Let's bring that back in and tentatively look at it. Work with it, enjoy it without believing in it ultimately. So that's what Yogacara is. So if we look at the history of Buddhism, we see these point, counterpoint, all the way through to modern day. So that's my response to that. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, except that I think the pinnacle of the garden is being sort of seen.
Pardon? Well, he does equate them, but he also says that his middle way is not between. It's not between anything. That it's a collapsing of the division. He says, my middle way is not the middle way of the early Buddhists, where they said this, and then on the other hand, on the other side, this, and stay in between. Let's collapse those differences, which we need to do. We need to do. However, however. But there's always however. Mizuki Roshi, my teacher's book, one of his most famous books is It's Not Always So. Right? 150 pages on that. Anybody else? Yeah.
Could you give some more examples of how non-relationship can play out in relationship? How that?
Sure, sure. Well, the more we get, the more we sink into non-relationship, into a peace that's not of time. It's not of time. It's not of time. The more we sink into that, the more in relationships we're able to be fluid. We're able to not cling to our own way of doing things and just begin to appreciate our way and someone else's way experience a non-contingent calmness that isn't dependent on emotion. And that non-contingent calmness then can allow us to help others cultivate healthy emotions and help ourselves cultivate healthy emotions, because we're always secure. We're always secure right in the middle of insecurity, right in the middle of the body totally not behaving, a mind not behaving. There's a fundamental security that allows us to be at ease with others, and that helps us, and it helps others too. Anybody else? Nobody else, huh? Okay.